Whatever you need to do, I can.
Well, I appreciate that.
Sip on this in the interim or whatever. You're scaring me. You're gonna pick my brain off.
I hope so. Put the sugar in and get it.
Your baseball. But it wasn't the game itself, it was the people in it.
Yeah.
And Fred Haney certainly belonged there. You know, all the people that cared, I think guys went to the ballpark to play. Now they go because they have to.
Yeah, exactly.
Is this going to be in the way?
No. All right?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Vincent, whenever you're ready, sir.
Okay, give me the five.
Okay, hold on 1 second. In 5, 4, 3, 2.
Warren Spahn, thank you very much for being here. We're talking about your life in baseball. And I guess I want to go back to the very earliest memories you have of baseball. When did you get your first glove? Talk about your father's role in helping you get interested in baseball in Buffalo. And just tell us about your first recollections of baseball.
Well, my dad was an amateur ball player. And he loved the game. And of course, his son played baseball. And well, in those days, it was during the Depression. And I didn't even have a left-handed glove. That I had a right-handed glove, one of his. And I didn't know the thumb was supposed to be on this side. So I played with a glove that had the thumb over here.
Yeah.
And I guess I learned how to catch with it maybe better than kids do today because they got the big long gloves and all that sort of stuff. And it was a love affair. I enjoyed playing baseball. I played in a great municipal league that they had in Buffalo, along with my high school, American Legion. I think I was playing almost every day.
Were you always a pitcher?
No, I wanted to be a first baseman.
Because you were left-handed?
Yes. And my father played third base, and I played first base on the same ball club, the South Bethel Businessmen's whatever. And I used to give him heck for throwing me bad throws, and he'd give me heck for not catching the ones that he threw badly that, you know, I was the first baseman. I was supposed to catch those. And we had a good relationship, and baseball was the catalyst that made it closer together, father and son. And when I went to high school, the young man that was playing first base for my high school was all-high first baseman. So I realized that I wasn't going to beat him out. And they needed pitching, and that's when I started to pitch. And interestingly, my wife and Stan Musial's wife both agreed that he went from pitcher to the outfield and I went from first base to pitching. We made the right decision.
Yeah.
And I guess we did. Stan did pretty well.
I understand that you went undefeated junior and senior year. Is there a correlation between your father being a perfectionist, teaching you how to throw correctly? I read in your biographies that he said if you don't throw correctly, don't bother to throw at all. Could you talk about that?
Well,
education?
My dad was a little man, about 5'7", probably weighed 150 pounds. And he realized the value of using all of what God gave you. That's momentum, etc. And he insisted that I throw correctly and use my whole body to pitch. And, you know, he was responsible for that. And I used to hate to come home from school because he wanted to play catch when I came home. And he'd always make me hit the target and that sort of thing. Not that I hated it, but just the fact that he was a taskmaster. And thank God for it.
Warren, did you always have that distinctive leg kick? Did that come right at the beginning, or did you develop that as you went through your career?
That's part of my father's influence. use all of the momentum that I could create. And then talking to hitters, I realized that I hid the ball pretty well, so that it looked like it was coming out of my uniform. So I tried to encourage that. I didn't want to talk to pitchers, I wanted to talk to hitters. And I think hitters the same way. And so over the years, I remember that, I realized where the assets were and embellished on it. And Johnny Cooney, who was an outfielder and a coach with us, we didn't have coaches. They were just part-time whatever. And Johnny Cooney was the pitching coach. And he told me that I shouldn't raise my right shoulder like I did when I pitched, that I'd lose sight of home plate, et cetera, and whatever. Mm-hmm. But I could never break that habit. And I think another interesting thing about my delivery is that when I was in high school, I played football and I was an end. Two guys and I landed on my right shoulder and dislocated my shoulder. And as a result, I couldn't throw it up in the air like a lot of pitchers do. Mm-hmm. So I kept it tucked inside, which happened to be the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And that helped me with my delivery also.
But you had great control. Was that in part due to your father's forcing you to practice and throw?
I mean, no, that might be part of it, but I think the hitters made me have good control. You don't throw through the middle of the plate.
Yeah.
And, I think the philosophy that I used was that the 15 inches in the middle of the plate belonged to the hitter, and that the 2.5 inches or 2 inches on either side is where you have to pitch. And when you stop to think about it, a hitter goes up to home plate and he takes a stance to protect most of the strike zone or what he's comfortable with. So you pitch against that grain.
Is it fair to say you were taught how to pitch, not taught how to throw?
I hope so. My dad was a good competitor. He was a good teacher, and all the things that he taught me were ingrained in me throughout my baseball career, and I can't think of any coach or manager that influenced my career as much as my dad did.
Talk about him a little bit, because values play a big role. I mean, you obviously had not just a great baseball career, but a life that reflects a set of values. What was he like? What did he do for a living, and what did he pass on to you that you remember as being very valuable?
Well, my dad was a wallpaper salesman. And, again, I go back to the era that we grew up in, is that it was the Depression. And, my dad made $27 a week, I think, and supported a family of he and his wife and six kids. So, we had to be pretty careful where we spend things. And my dad never had a car. We rented. We didn't own our own home. So as far as a sense of values, I think take care of what you got, because there might not be something else. And I remember sewing up baseballs because we didn't have a baseball to play with. And those trends, I wish we could throw some of those things at our kids today. But it was a sign of the times at that time. And my dad's values were, eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and give no quarter and ask none. Play the game as hard as you can, and put your brain in gear before you physically put your body in gear. So I think those traits helped me a lot.
When you would go to see the Buffalo Bisons with your dad, was it to study baseball, or were those the fun times where you just talked?
You know a lot about me. My dad used to take me to the ball games, and we sat out in left field that were kind of like bootleg seats. And Ollie Carnegie and Ollie Tucker were the big people that pitched for Buffalo. And he'd point out the good features of those people. And I remember they had a pitching staff of the three B's, Brewer, Bartulis, and somebody else. But, you know, he'd have me watch them and turn the bad things into good things that they didn't do or did do. And I think the background of baseball was good from watching those guys.
Warren, you're obviously the most successful left-hander ever, and there's always stereotypes about left-handers. When you were a kid and you were throwing left-handed, was any of that relevant to you? I say that because you had good control. The stereotype is left-handers are generally wild. You were a very straight, you know, you fought, you served your country.
Unorthodox left-hander.
Yeah, you were a straight left-hander. Is there something to that? You're also the most successful. Is there anything to that business? Can you generalize about left-handers, or are you the person that refutes all the generalizations?
I think I might be the exception. I don't really know why left-handers are more wild than right-handers.
You think it's true?
I don't know. You know, John Rocker certainly helped me be convinced of that.
Yeah.
And then there were also theories that pitchers were unorthodox as left-handers, and then the heart's closer to the left side. I don't know any of those things. I know that there's a great demand in baseball today for left-handed pitchers.
But when you were coming along, was there a left-hander that you emulated or admired, or somebody you particularly thought well of who affected the way you pitched?
Well, Lefty Grove, Herb Pennock, Carl Hubbell, but I didn't get to see those people. I never saw a major league game until I played in one. But I heard about those people, and of course, we got the radio broadcast of the Yankee games, so that I knew of those people. And I got the hit against Carl Hubbell when he was with the Giants and I was with the Braves when I first came up. And I remember hitting against him, and first of all, you're looking for the breaking ball away from you, and he threw me that screwball that was bigger than any right-hander's curveball. And it looked goofy coming from a left-hander and then break in on me like that. Mm-hmm. So that influenced me a great deal. I guess I idolized guys like Lou Gehrig, for example. I never saw Lou play. I never got to meet him, but I idolized him. He was from Cornell, I believe. He was the opposite of Babe Ruth. He was a good-looking guy. He looked like Tarzan. And so that he was my idol when I was a kid.
Talk a little bit about high school and American Legion. Did anybody in those years play a role? Did they try to teach you things that, for example, a curveball? Who taught you to throw the curveball?
I don't think anybody did.
You just knew how to do it?
No, I experimented. And I don't think I had the greatest curveball in the world, but I had a quick breaking ball. And I remember Larry Doby had a lot of trouble with me in the World Series in 48. And he came up to me one day and says, "What is that pitch?" And after I told him, he hit me better than he did before. You know, he conned me. But I had a quick curveball, and I was able to throw it on the outside corner to right-handed hitters. In fact, Willie Mays hit his first home run off me, and his first hit in the big leagues was that very same curveball that Robin Roberts had pitched against him. They had series with the Phillies in the beginning of the year, and I think Willie was like 0 for 23, and he was worried about getting sent out. So I was told that he couldn't handle a curveball on the outside part of the plate. But they forgot to tell me that was from a right-hander.
Yeah.
And he knocked a couple of seats out in the Polo Grounds, and that was Willie's first hit. And yeah, you don't forget those things.
Well, how about the American Legion? Was that a good experience? Did you have fun playing American Legion ball?
Of course, sure. It was an opportunity to play. I don't recall how well organized the American Legion was in those days. And as far as Mr. Schumacher, who was my baseball coach at South Park High School, didn't know beans about the game or pitching, but you know, he was the coach. And I guess most of the things that I learned throughout my baseball career were just pick up a piece here and a piece there to develop what I had to work with.
When did you first think that you might become a professional player? When did it occur to you that you were pretty good and that you might make a life of baseball? Was it in high school?
Well, I went into baseball right out of high school.
Yes.
But I never dreamed that I was going to be a professional, and when I got that opportunity, I grabbed it. And I remember that guys that were graduating out of high school with me were making like $15, $17 a week working in the steel mills. And I was making $20 playing in Class D baseball, so I was delighted to play baseball number one and make more money than those guys did.
Was it much of a decision? I know that you had some interest in Cornell, and that's where Garrick went.
Gee, you've done a lot of work. I had a scholarship to Cornell, but it was only books and tuition, or maybe just books, I don't remember. And my family couldn't afford to send me to college. So I thought this is an opportunity to make money after I got out of high school. And I thought if there was anything in my future as far as college is concerned, I'd take that up at a later date.
And we're talking 1938, 37, you graduated from high school.
Mm-hmm.
And was it, well, tell us about your signing or the scouts. When did you bump into scouts and how did you sign your first contract?
I only knew one scout, and I think he was a bird dog for the Braves, and he worked for the New York Central Railroad. And he offered me a contract, which I grabbed. And after that, I think I had inquisitions from the Yankees and whatever that they wanted to sign me, but I'd already signed with the Braves. And, you know, to make it sensible in my own mind, I thought, well, I made a good decision, because if I was going to get to the big leagues, I'd have an opportunity to do it with the Braves rather than the Yankees. Because I remember the Yankees, when they had a great ball club in Newark, that could have competed with the Yankees in the
right,
big leagues.
Exactly.
So I think it was a step in the right direction. And all I wanted to do was play. I enjoyed it so much. And you know, I played in a half a year in Class D. The following year, I went to Class B with Evansville. And then I went to Class A after I came up with the Braves. And then I went into service.
Let's go through that a little, take a little time. Talk to us about your first day in organized baseball. You report to the Class D team. You're obviously thrilled to be there. Can you tell us what your thoughts were and what your feelings were when you first went into organized baseball?
Yeah, I got off the train and I was lost. I didn't know where I was. And I had to find out where the ball club was, you know, where their headquarters was, where the ballpark was. Just the fact that I was in professional baseball, and you know, they didn't measure us for uniforms in those days, they just handed you one. And I remember getting off the train and I was scared to death, and yet I was excited. The manager gave me an opportunity to start a ball game, and I was thrilled with that. And you know, you don't go to any places on $20 a week. So I'd buy a meal ticket in a diner. Then I knew I was going to eat for the week and rented a room, and I'm all set.
Do you remember the manager? Who was the manager?
Two brothers. Let's see. I wanted to say Eddie Onslow.
Was he not? I mean, was he somebody that you related to? Did he treat you well?
Hey, he was the boss. I don't remember how well he treated me. He was just the manager, and I did what he told me to do.
Had that been the first time you left Buffalo? I believe you were in Pennsylvania at your first stop?
Yes, Bradford, Pennsylvania.
First trip away from home?
Oh yeah, 80 miles away, and it could have been 9,000 miles as far as I was concerned. And that was my first experience away from home. And ironically, I got the bright idea that I was gonna throw a curveball that would break big. And instead of getting my fingers on top of the ball, I tried to throw it this way. And when I did, I hurt my elbow. Uh-huh. And the ball club sent me to a chiropractor in somewhere outside of Bradford, I remember. And this guy manipulated my elbow, and I thought he was tearing it apart. And apparently a tendon had slipped from one place to another, and he put that back in place. And he put my arm in a sling, told me to go home and forget baseball for the rest of that year. And he wouldn't even let me comb my hair with my left arm. And then I think that was really a break, because the Braves organization sent me to Evansville, where Bob Coleman was the manager, who was an outstanding teacher, and I never had trouble with my elbow again.
And Warren, did you, from the beginning, have enough confidence that you were pretty certain you'd be able to succeed? I mean, did you have doubts about your ability to?
Of course, sure, Faith. You know, all I know is that the hitters told you a story. And if you threw a pitch and a guy hit it hard, well, maybe you better go back to the drawing board. And I know there were times when I was able to throw the ball by the hitter. It made me feel pretty good. And so we didn't have a gun in those days. Everything was trial and error. And, you know, I learned the breaking ball. You know, throw two fastballs and a curveball and the guy's out. And then I developed a change, which was a palm ball that Hal Schumacher used to throw. And those I think I taught myself. And I remember Bob Coleman, our manager at Evansville, wonderful guy. And he was so demanding. And I remember he told me one time, he said, look, any of these guys can make a mistake, but you're going to pitch in the big leagues. And he said, you're allowed a mistake once. And I remember it was a double play ball hit back to me. And instead of throwing to second base for the double play to get out of the inning, I threw home to get the runner that was scoring. And he chewed me out for that. And those things are indelible. You don't forget those. And so I think he recognized that I had potential, and as I say, he sent more people to the big leagues than any manager in minor league baseball.
But you're regarded by many as a example of a great pitcher, but someone who was also a wonderful fielder, a good hitter. You could do it all. How hard did you work on those things as a kid? Were they part of your...
Faye, we used to play pepper. Remember that game?
Yeah. No pepper
it's
allowed.
It's banned in baseball now. Yeah. But that taught you reflexes. It taught you to feel your position. And remember, we used to play pepper. Burdette and I used to play pepper until we couldn't move anymore. But that's the reason that you were able to feel your position and also get in position to feel the ball. I don't know. All those things were just a fun part of baseball.
What do you see now when a pitcher, left-handed pitcher, falls off the mound going toward third base? You say to yourself, how can that be? I mean, he can't feel that position.
Well,
you obviously didn't do that. Somebody had you very well coached to finish with your feet
even. Hey, look, when you're less than 60 feet away from the hitter with just a glove to protect yourself, I think maybe you get in position to feel the ball. And I remember Jim Bunning. Who was in such bad position that he caught a ball behind his bat that was, or back rather, that was hit back at him.
Yeah.
And, even Bob Gibson would fly all over the place when he was pitching, but he exerted so much energy when he was pitching, so I could understand that. but I wanted to protect myself.
How about hitting and bunting? You could do all those things. Did you work at the hitting, or was that just a function of you being a good athlete?
Oh, I wanted to play every day, and I wanted to be good enough to maybe play another position. This is where the first base came in. And I wanted to be a better hitter than the guy that Fred Haney or any other manager, Billy Southward, had on the bench to pinch hit for me. So it helped. You know, there were situations where I stayed in the ball game where maybe another pitcher wouldn't because I had potential. And I wasn't a good hitter, but I was a dangerous out.
It sounds as if you put a lot of intelligence into every aspect of the game.
Thank you.
Which a lot of ball players aren't readily accused of doing. So I know Johnny Saint said you were one of the smartest men ever to play the game. Did you always break it down from the time you were a little kid? And is that an influence of your father, again?
Probably. But then again, what else have you got to do when you only go out there to pitch every fourth day? Or now it's 5 days. So you watch other people. And mistakes that they make, I'd like to be one step ahead of them. I wasn't the biggest guy in the world, so instead of brawn, you try to think your way through situations. And I think it helped me in my career.
Did you keep a book, or was it all up here? You have a photographic memory?
How many pitchers watch hitters take batting practice? I used to make a study of it. And, you know, if you watch a hitter taking batting practice, he'll tell you what he can't hit. So I tried to embellish on those things, except Musial. I don't think I ever found out how to hit a pitch against him.
But you weren't alone.
I know. But, you know, I had a favorite slogan that there were a lot of Polish hitters in baseball, and they all seemed to be high fastball hitters. So I made up my mind I wasn't going to pitch Polacks, if you will, Polish people high. And the mad Russian that came up with the Cubs, Lou Novikov, when I first came up to the big leagues, he was hitting against me in Chicago, and I threw two fastballs right down the middle past him. And now I was taught to waste a pitch, so I threw a ball over his head. And he hit a line drive through my legs. I thought, whoa. He was Russian or Polish. Don't pitch those people high.
We're going to take a break right here.
Well, I'd love it.
Four, three, two.
Warren, we're talking about your minor league career. You're at Evansville.